Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books Network. I'm your host, Schneer Zalman Neufeld. In To Fulfill These Rights, Political Struggle Over Affirmative Action and Open Admissions, published by Columbia University Press in 2019, Amaka Okechukwu offers a historically informed sociological account of the struggles over affirmative action and open admissions in higher education. Through case studies of policy retrenchment at public universities, she documents the protracted, but not always successful, rollback of inclusive policies in the context of shifting race and class politics. To Fulfill These Rights provides a new analysis of the politics of higher education, centering the changing understanding and practices of race and class in the United States. Amaka is an assistant professor of sociology at George Mason University. I'm so glad her new book has brought her to our program. And I should also add that Mark and I were together in graduate school at NYU, and I'm especially glad to be interviewing her today. Welcome, Amaka.
Thank you for having me, Zalman.
Absolutely. It's wonderful to have you here. So to get started, could you please tell us a little bit about your background and what led you to write this work?
Of course. I think two things led me to begin this project. So first, I think it's important to mention that this book started off as a dissertation at NYU Sociology. And in New York, I was pretty active in organizations, leftist organizations in the city. And one organization that I was pretty active in was the Brecht Forum, which was a sort of leftist Marxist political space in New York. And through my time there, as well as other organizations, I kept running across essentially a cohort of activists that were really impressive to me. They had really sharp political analyses, and they all seemed to know each other. They all seemed to have gone to college with each other. And it was interesting to me. And I found out that they were all members of an organization called Student Liberation Action Movement, which was active in the CUNY system in the 90s and the early 2000s. And so I thought this was an interesting story here, that all of these people had kind of gone to college with each other and were all active in various organizations and movements in the city. And so through my conversations and just interaction with folks from SLAM, I learned that they had actually done work to document what it is that they were doing at the time. They had donated over 20 boxes of materials to NYU's Tamamit Library, and no one had really done anything with those materials. And there was also a sort of a grassroots effort among each other to document their stories through oral histories. And so I thought this would be really interesting for me to, you know, dive into this collection. And I have personal relationships with a lot of these people, so it'd be a really great opportunity for me to interview folks as well. And so I wanted to talk or sort of explore SLAM in more depth. I found out that they were connected to student organizers at UC Berkeley who were organizing against affirmative action retrenchment at the same time that CUNY students were organizing against open admissions retrenchment. And I thought that was an interesting story. And so I went to my committee with this project, and they forced me to expand the project, which I think was a good thing to do. But I was really interested in researching organizing of young people. And so that is one really key thing that brought me to this project. And, you know, of course, there's evidence of that in the book. I think the second thing, which I'll be more brief about, is that I grew up in California. I was a young person when Proposition 209 was passed. I remember the organizing that was happening around that time. I remember being in conversation with friends of mine who were Black, who were National Merit Scholars, who said that they weren't going to apply to UC Berkeley because they didn't feel welcome there. They didn't feel like it was a hospitable environment for them. And so I remember growing up and hearing about this and experiencing it and having it shape my political consciousness growing up in California. And so I would say that those two experiences really informed me coming to this project as a researcher.
Right. That's really, really interesting. To set the stage a bit for our discussion, could you tell us a little bit about the rate of attainment of bachelor degrees for white people versus Black people today in the U.S.? Is there a big difference in those rates, and what does that look like?
I wish I could provide a more satisfactory answer. I'm not a good, my memory is never good with numbers, so I'll just say that. But for me, it was interesting to explore these questions of educational access at both a working class institution like CUNY, as well as elite public institutions like Michigan, Berkeley, University of Texas, Austin, because I felt that a lot of the conversation around educational access, in particular affirmative action, really centered on elite institutions. These are institutions that the majority of Americans of any race, ethnic group, class background are not going to have access to, right? This is a very small number of people that are able to gain admission into these institutions and gain admission into the kinds of elite networks that, are related to, you know, people in various power positions in this country. And so it was interesting for me to think about affirmative action and these elite institutions in relationship to an institution like CUNY, which does a lot of work in educating the working class. Because of that, there is a lot of positive statistical data available on, the movement of people into middle class after getting a CUNY degree in terms of class mobility. And so I thought that was a really interesting connection there to think about the two policies in relationship to each other and to think about thus the success of both of the policies, but also the kinds of coordinated retrenchment and a lot of the similarities that you see in both cases, as well as the involvement of various organizations that were active in both cases. So that's what is more interesting to me about the story.
Sure. I totally hear that. Two quick things. First of all, for people that are just not familiar with this, CUNY refers to the City University of New York, right? The city, college university system.
Yes.
And also I'm completely there with you in terms of not being a numbers person. And because of that, when I prepared for interviews that deal with, you know, mentioned numbers, I try to write them down because I am terrible at remembering this kind of thing. And one number that jumped out at me from your book was that you said that 43% of white people were receiving bachelor degrees today versus only 23% of Blacks. So that the numbers, although as I'm sure you would agree, hardly tell the whole story, but they give a little window into just how stark the gap in college attainment between people of different racial backgrounds in America, even today, still
absolutely.
Is.
Thank you for finding that statistic. It's always so interesting because I mentioned I'm not a numbers person, but I think anyone that's written a book will also recognize that, you know, even though you've written it, you kind of have to return back to the material, and it's not the same as being in it when you're writing it, right? So thank you for mentioning that.
Of course. I mean, I'm shocked sometimes when people mention things from my book and I'm like, I wrote that. Like, you know, you write it, you're in it afterwards. Of course, it's hard to remember, especially numbers. But I wanted just to put out that number because it seemed, you know, really to highlight, as you do so well in the book, the really stark difference that or gulf that still persists in college attainment. Speaking of a college attainment, again, just to kind of set the stage here a bit, if you could speak a little bit about for-profit colleges, when people are thinking about, you know, what colleges, you know, Americans are attending, there is a whole system of for-profit colleges, and I'm wondering if you could speak a drop about how many of the people or the extent to which Black people are much more involved in, you know, attending for-profit colleges versus, you know, regular not-for-profit colleges.
Right. Of course, I don't have the statistical information, but I do know that Black people and generally lower-income people are more vulnerable to getting caught up in the for-profit college enterprise, which tends to be a very exploitative enterprise. When we talk about the amount of student debt that we hold as a nation, a large percentage of that debt comes from people who have attended for-profit colleges and have to take out loans for that experience. I would certainly suggest Tressie McMillan Cotton's book, which really deals with for-profit colleges in a really detailed and nuanced manner, because that's not my expertise. But I do think that it is important to think about the field of higher education as a whole and the many ways in which people are being disadvantaged and exploited through this process. And for-profit colleges is certainly a huge area where people are being exploited. And then, you know, most people not even leaving with degrees to show for it, but just a lot of debt. So that's certainly a major space of inequality and exploitation in the present day.
Right, right. And so basically the upshot is that it would be much better for the American society in general and for the individual people involved if they were able to attend a sort of regular, quote unquote, for a not-for-profit college or university like the public educational institutions like the CUNY, the City University of New York, or the college systems in California or other states. So speaking of that, this brings us to the issue of affirmative action and open admissions. And your book, of course, looks at great detail at both of these policies. Could you tell us just again to get us started here, how you define affirmative action? Exactly kind of what are we talking about when we're talking about affirmative action policies?
Right. Affirmative action is actually a very big category, and it's generally policies and programs that are extended to historically excluded groups of people in higher education and in employment. I focus on higher education, and I specifically focus on admissions to universities. Now, people have this understanding that quotas are the primary way that affirmative action functions in this country, and that is incorrect. Quotas have been illegal since 1978. Institutions are very wary of being legally vulnerable and legally targeted. And so institutions do not use quotas, which includes grid systems, point systems, separate committees to admit students, those sorts of things. Those efforts are not used. The primary means by which affirmative action is employed in admissions is through a holistic consideration of an applicant's whole file, right? And so it would be one factor of many factors, right? That is a legal sort of a definition, and that is also how it functions in universities in this country. I think it's really important to understand that affirmative action primarily functions at selective elite institutions, right? So that these are institutions in which a small percentage of those who apply are admitted. Most universities, thus, in this country do not employ affirmative action because they do not have to. Most institutions are not selective and most institutions are not elite. And so that is how I sort of look to affirmative action. But it can also include programs, summer bridge programs. It can include programs that are aimed at preparing students of color for graduate school, for professional school. It's a very large container. But when most people talk about affirmative action, they're talking about the use of it in university admissions.
Right, right. Thank you for that, those clarifications. And then also, if you could describe a little bit what you mean by the open admissions policies. What exactly does that refer
to? So open admissions, or it's also called open enrollment, is the policy that most would be familiar with when they think of a community college, right? Having a high school diploma and perhaps minimal other qualifications that would allow someone admittance into an institution. I focus on the City University of New York and their implementation of open admissions because it is the largest university system that has ever employed open admissions. And that open admissions applied to both community colleges and the senior colleges, the four-year colleges. And so in that way, it's a very important experiment to look to in that regard. And it had a really huge impact and really opening up education in the city of New York. And like I said, really played an important role in the class mobility of working class people in the city. And so in this case, the University of New York is a working class institution. It is a more accessible institution, right? So it's not an elite or selective place. And I was interested in how open enrollment worked in the four-year colleges, and more specifically, the struggle over that policy over the years from the 60s on. And so these are very different policies that function in different institutions, but or different kinds of institutions, but they both are related to access.
Right. Right. And you kind of touched on this before when you were talking about how the whole issue of affirmative action in higher education really only relates to a very, very small number of academic institutions. Because the, as you said, the sort of elite or highly selective institutions, whereas most academic institutions and certainly community colleges tend to have fairly fairly open policies to begin with. So this, you know, the issue of affirmative action is not really relevant. I'm curious how radical you feel affirmative action and open admissions programs are. In other words, to what extent can these programs fundamentally restructure the political economic system that we live under? If they were operating at the highest level, so to speak, the most expansive view of these programs.
Right. That's a really good question. And it's something that I struggled with when I was entering this project. I think that these policies, considering, I don't see them as the most radical problems, right? The most radical solutions. I don't think that affirmative action or open admissions can solve the social problems, can deal with the problems that advanced capitalism has placed us in, right? I do see them as creating an open path for some, though. You know, it is a space of access and a space of class mobility for some the people that are able to access it, right? But I don't see it. I don't see either policy as revolutionary in the sense that that they by themselves can transform a society so shaped by exploitation and various forms of violence and oppression. But that doesn't mean that they're not important, right? But the thing is that they function within a constrained context, right? And so that is the problem. But I do see them as progressive. I see them as progressive policies. I do think that thinking about threats to these policies are important for a variety of reasons. But I think one is because a lot of what we see in this sort of field can also be applied in other fields, right? In regards to the conservative strategies and tactics and forms of retrenchment We know that a lot of these actors are not just functioning in a space of education. They're functioning in other spaces as well. So I think from a perspective of movements and strategy, I think there's a lot to learn from these cases.
Right. So it's almost like these programs and efforts of affirmative action and open admissions are almost like a litmus test to give us a sense of people who are pro or people who are anti, gives us a sense of how they feel about a lot of other parts of American society and institutional life.
Yes, and what they do in these areas, right? So it is, of course, how people feel, but more so, you know, what are the tactics and strategies being developed in this arena to stop, to retrench these policies, and how might they be applied in other spaces? I think one of the things that also brought me to this project, it's just relevant, so I'm going to talk about. So briefly, one of the things that also when I was sort of developing this project, one of the things that I found interesting is that most of the literature that I could find on affirmative action and in particular sort of political and social science literature related to affirmative action was so focused on this sort of question or this positioning in the debate, right? Yes or no? Do we support affirmative action? Or do we reject affirmative action? What are the pros and cons? And for me, that was very unhelpful and very, it wasn't interesting to me. That was an interesting question. I saw these debates and these public struggles over, these policies as fights in a political field. And I was more interested in struggle over these policies and, right, the strategies, the tactics, the framing, how people are developing and employing ideas about race and racism through these struggles, rather than pro or con, right? I wasn't really interested in that dynamic. I'm, of course, in support of the policies, but I found that actually to be very uninteresting. And so I wanted to explore this topic in a different kind of way than I had seen before.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Right. I totally hear that. You mentioned the year. Either you're with me?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, yeah, we're good. Okay. Marco Polo, okay. You mentioned the year 1978 before, and I believe you're referring to the Supreme Court case of a Regents of the University of California versus Bakke. And I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about that case and how that shaped the realities and the discourse around affirmative action.
Right. So briefly, the Bakke case is a really significant case because to this day, it is probably the boundaries and the limits around affirmative action have legally been most defined by the Supreme Court case. This was a case in which Alan Bakke, he was applying to medical school. In the 1970s, medical school admissions were very... there was age discrimination that was definitely at play in medical school admissions. Alan Bakke had decided that he wanted a second career, so he was older, applying to medical school, and he applied to a variety of schools and was rejected, I believe, from all of the schools that he applied to. He decided to focus on the UC Davis rejection, and of course assisted by a variety of conservative legal organizations and think tanks. And he sued the institution for discrimination. He basically said that his rights had been violated under the Equal Protection Clause. And he sued UC Davis Medical School. And what came out of that case was, one, that quotas were made illegal. However, the legal rationale of diversity as a state interest was reinforced, right, which is something that we still hear today. And this shaped affirmative action in a variety of ways. One, quotas were outlawed.
Quotas to help people of color, just to be clear.
Yes, yes. So quotas functioning in the admissions process. So in the Davis, I'm trying to remember if the Davis case was one in which there was separate, I believe there were separate admissions committees to admit Black students and other students, white students, into the medical school class. And so quotas, you know, that is one way that people talk about quotas, the separate committees. It also functioned as, you know, we want 10 Black students. And so there's 10 seats for Black students, right? And so quotas were eliminated at that point. But also the legal rationale shifted. Prior to 1978, a lot of institutions had implemented affirmative action programs as a means of racial redress, right? This was very intentionally aiming to address past and present discrimination, right? And so affirmative action was developed as a means of racial redress. The Bakke decision eliminated that as a legal rationale, but they said instead, the ability to compose diverse classes in a diverse campus culture is legally permissible, and it's a good thing, right? And this was largely based off of the affirmative action plan in place at Harvard at the time. And so after this case, universities across the country went to go revise their programs because they did not want to be legally, they did not want to end up in the court, right? Because these court cases are very expensive, millions and millions of dollars to go to the Supreme Court. So institutions changed their affirmative action programs. A lot of what we see now is diversity and retention programs or, diversity, and there's different kinds of languages, but we're all familiar, right? The offices on campus, most of those programs started off as explicitly affirmative action programs, but the language has been shifted. The procedures have been shifted. And so this was a really important case. Another reason why it was important is because there was no majority decision in this case, which makes it very confusing and which makes it sort of not easy, but it makes it more available to go to the Supreme Court, because cases that go to the Supreme Court are about creating uniformity in the law, having a final decision on something. And so this case was very important for that. The Powell decision the Powell opinion is what most people take as the decision in that case, but it was a plurality opinion, meaning that there was no majority. And so it was very confusing for lots of people, but advantageous for conservatives in their many, 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 many lawsuits against universities in various states, various university systems, and beyond. We are still dealing with lawsuits now. A lot of the figure, or Edward Bloom and his organizing, he is now focused on private institutions. He's moved on from a lot of these public institutions. He's suing Harvard. He's suing Princeton. It continues.
Right. I just want to go back to one thing about the Bakke decision that you mentioned, which I think people who are not familiar with this, I think might find this very odd, and tell me if I got the story right. It seems to me that the Powell decision, the Supreme Court Justice Powell, his decision in the case was essentially saying that you're not allowed to have some kind of affirmative action program to explicitly help Black people. But you could have special programs in order to ensure that there's at least some Black people on college campuses or university campuses in order essentially to help the rest of the students, that like we're not really trying to help the Black people in America. We're trying to create a sort of positive experience intellectually, socially, creatively for everyone else. And it would be beneficial to kind of sprinkle some yes. Black people into that mix. Did I get that right?
That is correct, right? So what comes out of this decision and continues, if you look at the more recent legal decisions, is that having a diverse campus is beneficial, right? It's about providing cultural exchange and being exposed to various experiences and ideas that kind of thing. Largely is constructed as benefits for white students. Diverse campuses. It's largely constructed as benefits for white students. So yes, that is correct. The way that you stated that is correct, and it's something that is rarely questioned, even in the present day, when we look at these legal cases and sort of what the implications of, yes, we should have a few Black students, just so that these white students, largely from elite backgrounds, can say that they have shared space and been in classroom conversations and group projects with Black people and perhaps other people of color. So very problematic.
Right, right. So you talk about in the book how this decision and the response to it has really pushed this idea of diversity as opposed to kind of racial equality. There's a real move for diversity. And you talk about how this could translate into kind of shallow tokenism. What do you mean? What do we mean by diversity? And what does it mean, shallow tokenism?
Right. So I talk about both diversity and colorblindness as these kind of dueling racial logics that are sort of being created and debated and struggled over in political struggle. And diversity is ever present. This is language that we hear every day in many different kinds of contexts. And it often is a sort of shallow, vague terminology, right? I hear people talk about diverse people, diverse ideas, many kinds of things. It's very confusing. A diverse person, which doesn't really exist, right? these are things that we hear frequently, right? And we kind of take it for granted. Diversity is, generally, of course, we see it as referring to sort of various forms of racial representation, where there are some Black people, some Latino people, some Asian people, some white people, right? Having some sort of racial representation. It kind of draws from multiculturalism in some ways. But I talk about it in regards to, right, one, what it means to move from racial redress to diversity as sort of compelling rationales for developing these programs. One that addresses racial inequality, or at least aims to address it, whether it's successful or not, is a different kind of question. But one that aims to address racial inequality, and one that can actually be co-opted into a variety of causes, a variety of places, fields, et cetera. And so I was concerned about the ways in which, for example, conservative organizations that are very explicit about rolling back all of the gains of the civil rights movement and any sort of progressive policy, but then use Black or, brown figures as the sort of spokespersons of these kinds of causes, right? For me, that's a form of racial tokenism. You're finding somebody, the one person, it might be one or two people to sort of be the spokesperson for a particular conservative, anti-Black cause, right? And I think that's an extreme example. But we can talk about tokenism in a variety of places, right? Fortune 500, there's, one or two Black people or whatever amount of Black people who are head of these, billion-dollar organizations. And yet the work that all of these organizations are doing is to extract and disadvantage and exploit and oppress Black people across the globe. I don't know if that's something that we really want, to see a Black person doing that work and sort of disenfranchising most Black people, right? And so for me, I think we have to really be critical about these questions around representation and tokenism, right? Taking a step back and seeing what is, do we really want to be holding up people of color in positions of power in which they are doing the work of exploitation and oppression and extraction. That is not a world that I want, right? But that is often what we are looking to when we're sort of thinking about diversity, particularly as it relates to positions of power and representation. And so I was trying to sort of tease some of that out in these battles over affirmative action and how diversity is a sort of phrasing that can be thus, you know, dragged everywhere and, you know, in some ways mean absolutely nothing.
Right, right. And to, speaking of all that, how did you mentioned about conservative think tanks and their involvement in the struggle against affirmative action policies? How did these conservative think tanks and legal defense organizations use the concept of race to fight against affirmative action through the federal court system in Texas and Michigan?
Right. Well, you know, in contrast to diversity, they tend to be fixated on color blindness. They were very much clear on drawing from what they considered to be, Martin Luther King and sort of civil rights language around color blindness, which again was around sort of being, explicitly sort of challenging white supremacy in particular ways, and not wanting race to be a barrier in life. They sort of took this language as a way to construct reverse racism, right? So that white students were being disadvantaged and discriminated against because of these policies. That these policies were, in fact, there were so many opportunities for non-whites, right? That it was actually shutting white people out of opportunity. And so this is the kind of logic and language that was being used in challenging policies at University of Michigan, University of Texas, Austin, and University of California, and in many, most cases, particularly with the ballot initiative and Board of Trustees, were pretty successful. The legal cases were less, I wouldn't say they were less successful because they actually were successful in many ways, but they were less, it was more of a slow rollback as opposed to a sort of final decision that has ended affirmative action.
Right. Well, speaking of university boards of trustees, what role did they play in the process of moving away from affirmative action in higher education?
Yeah, the board of trustees are I think anyone that's interested in higher education should really pay attention to the ways that public institutions in particular are run by board of trustees, right? They're the primary governing body of these institutions, and board of trustees have all the power in making decisions. And in particular, the University of California system and the City University of New York system, the Board of Trustees played pivotal, important roles in the rollback of these policies. In the UC system, affirmative action was first ended by trustee vote before it went to the ballot box in California. So it played a really important role. It's also important to note that in the past few years, the regents in the University of California system have actually reversed that decision. However, it does not matter because the ballot supersedes the trustee vote, right? So Prop 209 is still on the books. So that's important to mention. In the CUNY system, the board also played an important role in rolling back the policy of open admissions. Both of these boards featured sort of political opportunists that were very much interested in building greater careers as conservative spokespersons. Many of these people were connected to conservative think tanks. In the case of California, and I think the case for a lot of board of trustees, a lot of board members are appointed as sort of political favors by governors, mayors, and other political figures, right? So if you donate a lot of money to their campaign, you're able to get an appointment to the Board of Trustees. So I think Board of Trustees are really important to examine when we're thinking about the way that power functions in these institutions and the way that decision-making occurs in these institutions.
Right. And you mentioned about the ballot propositions. How did conservative opponents of affirmative action mobilize ballot propositions in their effort to roll back affirmative action?
Right. The UC case is the first one. And so I find it to be the most interesting because when we look to other states, so many of, you know, what occurs in those other states also happened in California. It was this experimental place. So in California, the ballot actually was the idea of two university professors and one university professor and one PhD. Let me be clear, you know, because in part, one of the resentment of the one that never became a professor, I think really does function in this. So let me be clear about that. But this, the Wood and Custard, and you know, they both had differing sort of rationales for why they believed that affirmative action was a bad thing. One professor was working at a Cal State University and just completely saw his classroom change demographics overnight and just didn't really understand what was happening. He was also very frustrated with the embrace of multiculturalism in university curriculum. The other PhD never was able to get a faculty job and was convinced that it was because of affirmative action that he was not able to get a university tenure track appointment. They came together, they studied the Civil Rights Act and other civil rights legislation to model their language and to sort of take language from, and they developed a proposition that would ban affirmative action throughout the state. The difficulty was that they didn't have any power, so who cares if they have this proposition. However, years go by and they're able to actually meet political opportunity and they're able to get connected to the governor and get connected to Ward Connerly, who's the governor's one of his appointees to the University Board of Regents in the University of California. And it becomes a political wedge issue. So the ballot proposition is passed in 1996, and so much of the sort of development of the campaign is happening in 1995 and the end of 1994. And so in terms of just relationship building and all of that. And so through these relationships, they're eventually able to get this proposition on the ballot in California. Essentially, if you have a couple million dollars, you can put whatever ballot you want onto the ballot. It really just takes money. And so they're able to get Proposition 209, which they call the California Civil Rights Initiative, onto the ballot. And they're pretty successful in passing it. It becomes a political wedge issue, meaning that in this specific case, this was the time in which conservatives really did not want Bill Clinton to have a second presidential run. And so they wanted to get a conservative that people would vote for. And the governor of California at the time was a potential pick. He ended up not becoming the nomination, but this was a way to sort of place him on a national forum, right? Where people would be able to look at him. Anyway, all that to say, it was a political wedge issue. It was successful. Affirmative action was banned throughout the state. Ward Connerly gets it in his mind where I can take this to whatever state that has a similar referendum process. And he takes it to many states, including Michigan, which I also talk about. And so the ballot initiative is the most successful way into eliminating affirmative action. And many states who have that referendum process were able to then pass similar ballots, such as in the state of Arizona, and you know, a variety of other states that I've mentioned in the book. So,
were there any states that had these types of ballot initiatives that against affirmative action that failed?
Right. Yeah, I talk about this in the one of my chapters. and I talk about the failure of the ballot in Missouri in particular, and also Colorado. And there's a variety of things that were happening in these places which prevented these ballots from passing. But I do think that because activists in these areas had the time of watching ballots pass in a variety of other states before getting to their states, they had time to prepare. They could observe what happened in other states, and they were able to do some effective organizing on the ground, which really shifted the framing of write these ballots. And so they failed in both of those cases. Timing is also important. Both of Ward Connerly aims to pass these anti-affirmative action ballot initiatives at the same time that Barack Obama is running for the first for his first 4 years, which we all remember was a moment of mass interest organizing, lots of get out the vote, and you know, lots of progressive people coming out to vote. And that, I think, also played a role in those not passing. But I talk about it in more detail in the book. I'll just leave it there for now.
Sure. And you, in the beginning of our conversation, you talked about your interest in doing research on the students that were mobilizing in New York and in California to resist anti-affirmative action initiatives. How did these student activists on college campuses in New York and California try to resist this this push against affirmative action?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Because I can't hear you now. I can hear you now. I can hear you now. You went out for a minute. Okay. I did hear the question.
Okay.
So, you know, one of my most favorite chapters in the book deals with student mobilization in New York and in California. And that is in part because, as I mentioned before, there were connections between the two groups of organizers. And I also published an article in City and Community that goes into more depth about this, with the CUNY case in particular. So student activists, of course, resisted, right? They didn't take this laying down. In the CUNY case, student organizing emerged immediately to fight against retrenchment. This occurred in a variety of ways, and I think it's important to note that, you know, CUNY has a sort of a robust history of organizing on the left. These student organizers were not just students. They were organizers in the city. They were connected to other organizations that were, you know, fighting police brutality, fighting attacks on immigrants, fighting a variety of other issues, right? And so they were connected and were embedded in a network of movement activity in New York. And so, which I think is a benefit of their organizing. So they aim to resist open admission through mass mobilization, through, you know, civil disobedience, interrupting Board of Trustee meetings. They did a lot of really important investigative reporting about the connections between the conservative think tanks, in particular the Manhattan Institute, and the role of people on the Board of Trustees, the role of the Schmidt Commission, which was a sort of external Board of Trustees that Giuliani formed to basically force retrenchment. And so they did a lot of important reporting related to that, which I think is important because a lot of the mainstream media wasn't covering a lot of this. And so they did a lot of work to you know, stop the retrenchment. They got together with faculty and sued the Board of Trustees once open admissions was first eliminated in the CUNY system. So a lot of things happened. They were unfortunately unsuccessful, but you know, they did a lot of really important organizing on the West Coast. Again, students were involved in a lot of the same things, mass mobilization, civil disobedience. Students were key in developing, you know, wider coalitions that extended throughout the state that aimed to resist the ballot proposition, that aimed to get out the vote so people would vote against the proposition and that kind of thing. But they were also unsuccessful. You know, a lot of this had to do with political opportunity, right? A few, you know, college students were not going to, you know, it was going to be difficult for them to defeat a very well-resourced, you know, statewide ballot proposition. So I don't think it was the students' failure. I think a lot of this had to do with political opportunity. A lot of this had to do with the sort of forces that they were facing. But I think the student activist piece was really important for me to highlight because, you know, a generation of activists were developed during this time, and a lot of them are still very, very active across the country. So yeah, that's what really drew me to the project.
Right. And we discussed today, and you discuss at great length in your book about conservative attacks against affirmative action and these inclusive policies. But you also mention in the book that there are liberal opponents of affirmative action. What kind of arguments do liberals put forward in opposition to affirmative action policies?
Right. I mean, the main one that I see is class-based affirmative action. It's the idea that, affirmative action oriented around race, it's already been attacked. You know, let's just sort of surrender to that and just focus on class, right? Because that is more important. A lot of this is motivated by this idea that there's, you know, a huge cohort of Black elites that are just taking up these spaces, right? And so there are liberal, critics of affirmative action. They have played a role in some of these conservative court cases recently, particularly with Edward Bloom, and the kind of research that they're putting forth to support the end of affirmative action as we know it, and to sort of focus on a quote unquote class-based affirmative action. Which is, again, it's broad and vague. I talk about it in the book, and I talk about class-based affirmative action as something that could look like a variety of things. And, you know, it's not a one-size-fit-all kind of thing either. But yeah, that is one of the main, critiques, right? It's, let's just focus on class. That's more important.
All right. And what is, you talked about this a little bit earlier in the conversation, but what is the current status of affirmative action and open admissions policies in higher education?
Right. So as I mentioned before, open admissions mostly functions in community colleges. There isn't a four-year university that uses open admissions in this country. CUNY, you know, like I said, was the great experiment, and that they ended that in the 1999, and so that's been off the table, and only functioning in community colleges. Affirmative action still legal, but still being attacked. One of the things that I talk about in the book is that, though affirmative action has not been federally eliminated, the different court cases which have legislated the boundaries around affirmative action and which have essentially chipped away at affirmative action mean that a lot of its benefits have been lost, right? I open up the book talking about mobilization among student activists, Black student activists at University of Michigan, and how so many of their demands mirrored exactly the demands of student activists in 1970 at University of Michigan, and how demographically little has changed, right? And so part of why that is because, you know, we had these small moments with, you know, very minimal, but small moments of minimal change, right? And then that's all been foreclosed, right? That has been rolled back. And so in some ways, we're kind of back where we started, right. but it's still legal,
right? For now, right. All right. Again, you all touched on this a bit in the earlier in the conversation, but I'm curious to hear what you feel the study of the struggle over affirmative action in higher education tells us about the broader issue of race relations in America today?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that I was really interested in using this as a case to kind of explore the racial landscape in this country, and in thinking about the different ways that we understand race and how race is being employed in various spaces. This is still a country that has entrenched racial inequality. This is not something that we really have to debate over in 2021. Our last year has shown us this, both in regards to mobilizations over that really began around, you know, George Floyd being killed by the police, but really extended right beyond that. But also looking at the pandemic and the sort of racial impacts and implications of that as well, right? So we know that this is the country that is experiences deep and entrenched racial inequality. And I think for me, I was really interested in the ways in which this mapped onto the space of opportunity, right? The higher education, this is something that, you know, almost every group can agree is something that opens up the world in particular ways, right? And so I was interested in the space of education and in this space where, you know, class mobility and various ideas about the quote unquote American dream sort of live on, right? How is race and racial inequality showing up in this space? And I think that struggles over affirmative action as well as open admissions show us that there's still opportunity hoarding happening in this space. It shows us that racial inequality has shaped ideas around merit and around who we see as worthy of, you know, accessing higher education. And, you know, I forgot who I was talking to about this, even though I say this all the time. You know, I can't say that I ended the book very optimistically. And that just has to do with our particular social reality, to be honest, you know. I didn't feel optimistic when I ended the book. So much of how I understand affirmative action is that we don't have to eliminate it for us to see the impact of these attacks on these policies. So, it's not a rosy picture. But I do think that, right, things are worthy to struggle over. And I think education is one of those spaces. So hopefully this book can inform people who are interested in these kinds of questions, who are interested to see a historical, a longer take. This is not just about what happened in regards to Proposition 209 in 1996 in California. We can actually start 50 years before and think more critically about how access to higher education is connected to mobilization, is connected to the civil rights movement, is connected to the urban rebellions, right? Different forms of crisis and how that shapes, right, these different policies and who gets access to these policies. So yeah, I'll say that about it. Hopefully it can be helpful to people that are interested in those questions. Hopefully it can be helpful for people that are interested in studying the tactics and strategies of the right. I really hope that not just education scholars read this. I really, really am happy that most of the feedback that I've received has been from education scholars, but I think it's really important that people that are interested in politics and movements also read the book as well.
Right. Absolutely. And as you said, even though it may not be a rosy picture, it is an accurate picture. And it's always helpful to be accurate and to tell the truth about what's going on, because nothing positive could ever come from not knowing, you know, what the actual current or, you know, historical situation is or was. Okay, last question. Could you tell us about a new project you're currently working on?
For sure. I'm working on my next book project, which is very different. It's not an education. I think most people think that my next book would be related to education. This one is not. This next book project concerns community organizing and Black social life during the urban crisis in Central Brooklyn. So I'm looking at Black communities in Central Brooklyn and the ways in which the state sort of disappears, and the ways that people came together to meet their needs and to build community institutions and, build forms of cultural production and, you know, a variety of things, how they aim to, protect themselves, resist police brutality, resist forms of violence. So it's still very much in the early stages. The book is not coming out anytime soon. But I've been doing a lot of research over the years related to this. It's a qualitative research project. I've been doing oral histories with neighborhood residents for many years now related to this. And I've done extensive archival research. And so I'm really just interested in how Black people in particular and Black communities responded to state disinvestment, particularly during the 1970s and the 1980s. And so that's what my next project is, still related to movements, but also just dealing more so with urban sociology, Black communities. It's also, I think, is more a more interdisciplinary project. So I'm really enjoying working on it.
That's wonderful. Well, it sounds like another fascinating project. Well, thank you, Amaka, for taking the time to share your thoughts with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, that concludes our program. Thanks for listening and have a great day.